Welcome to As It Is, a 30-minute program designed for English learners. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English. We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world.
We begin today's program with stories about U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry's recent trip to Asia.
America's top diplomat was in Cambodia Tuesday on the second stop of his trip to Asia. Secretary of State John Kerry met with Cambodian government leaders and opposition party members in Phnom Penh. Kerry said the country has improved its human rights record and made economic progress. But he said he told officials that he was concerned about continued human rights violations. Kerry met separately with Prime Minister Hun Sen and acting opposition party leader Kem Sokha. After the meetings, the U.S. official said that democratic governments have a responsibility to ensure that all elected representatives are free to perform their responsibilities without fear of attack or arrest. 17 opposition members and activists are jailed in Cambodia. Opposition leader Sam Rongsi is living in self-declared exile to avoid charges made against him. Many observers believe the charges are unfair, and rights groups say the United States should not improve relations with Cambodia until its leaders guarantee reforms. Secretary Kerry also praised Cambodia for its economic progress. He told the Prime Minister that Cambodia has experienced remarkable growth. You have seen incredible changes, not just here in Phnom Penh, which moved from a 350,000-person war-torn city to a much more modern city of 2.2 million people.
The United States is increasing efforts to help Laos deal with several issues, including reducing hunger and disarming unexploded bombs in the countryside. Secretary of State Kerry talked about the new efforts during a visit to Vientiane, the Laotian capital, on Monday. He and the country's leaders discussed plans for a special meeting of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations next month in California. President Barack Obama will go to the meeting. After his talks with the Laotian leaders, Kerry told reporters that the U.S. is launching a $6 million program to help provide meals in schools across Laos. Hunger has affected the growth of Laotian children. Some are smaller than they would be if they had more to eat. Kerry thanked Prime Minister Thongsin Tomabong for help in dealing with issues related to the Vietnam War. There are still tons of unexploded ordnances in Laos. U.S. airplanes dropped the bombs during the war more than 40 years ago. An estimated 30% of them failed to explode. Kerry said the United States is considering whether to increase its financial assistance to help Laos with disarming and removing the bombs. The U.S. currently gives $19.5 million to help with those efforts. The Secretary of State also told reporters that he talked with the Laotian leaders about human rights and freedom of expression. Phil Robertson is the Deputy Asia Director of Human Rights Watch. He said, "Laos is one of the most repressive nations in ASEAN." Robertson said he hoped Kerry's visit to Laos would be the start of a strong U.S. push on the Lao government to end its intensified intimidation of civil society. In related news, the Lao Communist Party has announced a change in leadership. During a week-long party meeting, Bunyang Vorachit was named Secretary General. Bunyang is 78 years old. He has long-standing ties with Vietnam, dating back to military training and as a student. The Lao Communist Party also named Foreign Affairs Minister Thonglung Sisulit to the position of Prime Minister. Observers say the retirement of two pro-China members of the party's leadership may weaken Chinese influence on the country. China has been the largest foreign investor in Laos. Vietnam and Thailand are second and third on the list. State media said almost 700 delegates attended the Communist Party meeting in Vientiane. This was the 10th time the party has met since it took power in 1975. The group has more than 200,000 members. Titinan Pongsutirak is a political scientist at Chulalongkorn University in Thailand. He says the new party leaders will not make major policy changes. And he says the government will continue to fail to protect the rights of its citizens. The new leadership is more of the same, he said. More of the same in terms of repression and constraints on civil society and basic freedoms. We have had some scandals in the recent past over disappearances of civil society activists and human rights violations, so that is expected to be maintained.
Officials in Afghanistan say an Afghan policeman believed to have links to the Taliban killed 10 police officers in the central province of Uruzgan on Tuesday. Mario Ritter has more on the attack.
The attack took place early in the morning at a security area in the Chinarto district. A spokesman for the provincial governor said the killer drugged the officers before shooting them. The spokesman also said the suspected killer is missing from the security area along with a vehicle and weapons and other equipment that belonged to the officers. But a Taliban spokesman said the officers were killed by militants who attacked and captured the security area and killed all of the policemen there. VOA was not able to confirm if the report from the Taliban spokesman is true. The reported attack on Afghan police by a police officer was the second so-called insider attack in the past 2 weeks in Uruzgan. Provincial officials say four police officers believed to be working with the Taliban killed 9 other officers on January 17th. The officials say the four officers then joined the Taliban, bringing their weapons and ammunition with them. Insider attacks were a major problem for U.S.-led NATO forces between 2007 and 2013. These attacks took place when Afghan soldiers joined Allied forces on combat missions. The Taliban has increased its attacks in Afghanistan over the past year. The attacks began soon after NATO combat troops left the country at the end of 2014. The Taliban attacks have killed or injured many Afghan security force members. I'm Mario Ritter.
Residents of the industrial U.S. city of Flint, Michigan, are demanding to know why their water supply has had dangerous levels of lead for more than a year. Anna Mateo and Dan Friedel have more.
Civil rights activists, Politicians and residents are calling the contamination of drinking water in an urban U.S. city a disaster, not just an emergency.
Michigan Governor Rick Snyder recently apologized for the water disaster in Flint, Michigan.
Snyder said he would use all his power as governor to solve the water crisis. Snyder asked state legislators for $28 million to fund a series of immediate actions. The money would be used for such things as supplying bottled water, replacing water filters and other fixtures in high-risk areas, testing children for high lead levels, and treating potential physical and emotional health issues. Snyder said the following statement to the people of Flint. Your families face a crisis you did not create and could not have prevented. I am sorry, and I will fix it. The Republican governor has become the target for much heated criticism because the crisis unfolded under his watch.
U.S. civil rights activists visited the Midwestern city of Flint, Michigan recently. Reverend Jesse Jackson is a longtime civil rights leader. He led a delegation of activists. They addressed a crowd of concerned and angered citizens sitting in a local church. Jackson spoke later to reporters. He said the residents of Flint have been exposed to contaminated drinking and bathing water for nearly 2 years. Jackson described the city as a crime scene.
Flint is an industrial urban area of the state. It is largely an African-American city where 40% of the population lives in poverty. Jackson's visit to Flint came one day after President Barack Obama declared a local state of emergency. This clears the way for federal aid to reach the residents. Obama's visit came a day after another visit by controversial filmmaker Michael Moore. Moore was raised in Flint. He made the 1989 documentary film Roger and Me. The film is about the closing of several automobile plants in Flint by CEO of General Motors, Roger Smith. Speaking at City Hall, Moore said the situation is not just a water crisis. It is a racial crisis. It is a poverty crisis.
The water crisis began in 2014. The city of Flint was in deep financial difficulty. To save money, the city began using water from a local river rather than using pre-treated water from the water system of Detroit, a nearby city. However, the water in the Flint River is highly corrosive. Officials did not properly treat the corrosive water before sending it through lead pipes and into people's homes. Corrosive means to cause damage to metal or other materials through a chemical process, and that is just what happened. As the corrosive water traveled through the system of old lead pipes, lead seeped or leached into the water.
To make matters worse, officials did not tell Flint residents about their tainted drinking water supply for a year and a half. Now the people of Flint are demanding to know who knew what and when.
Health experts report finding dangerously high levels of lead in the city's children. State officials have begun importing bottled water to protect locals from further contamination.
Dr. Mona Hannah Atisha is director of pediatric residency at Hurley Children's Hospital. She is being called a hero by many. The doctor brought the problem of high levels of lead in children to the public's attention. She did this after state agencies first ignored her concerns. In a television interview, she says it is well documented that high levels of lead in children can lead to learning disabilities and emotional problems that follow the child into adulthood. Earlier this month, Michigan Governor Rick Snyder declared a state of emergency. This allowed the residents of Flint to go to fire stations for a daily case of water per household. But many blame Snyder for the crisis. Michigan Attorney General Bill Schuette announced that he will investigate the crisis to determine whether any state laws were broken. I'm Anna Mateo.
And I'm Dan Friedel.
Famous supermodels are known for their beautiful faces and figures. But there is another, more specialized kind of modeling, where feet, hands, earlobes, eyes, lips, and hair are the best features. Mary Gottschall tells us more about these body part models.
Gisele Bündchen, Cindy Crawford, and Kate Moss are some of the supermodels of the fashion world. But there are other highly paid models whose faces you've never seen. These people work in body parts modeling, a specialized area of the modeling business. You have probably seen their beautiful hands, exquisite feet, or fabulous earlobes in advertisements for elegant gloves, designer shoes, or expensive earrings. Parts models are in huge demand from companies who want the perfect hands, legs, feet, or other body parts to advertise their product, writes Vanessa Helmer, a modeling expert. Hands, feet, and legs are the most requested body parts for both men and women models. But, Helmer notes, if you have beautiful eyes, hair, earlobes, lips, or teeth, you can market those too. It is quite a profitable business. Forbes.com reported that top parts models earn around $1,000 per day for TV commercials and between $2,000 to $5,000 a day for print work. A female parts model with great legs and feet can earn about $75,000 a year, and even more in New York City, which is home to major advertising agencies. If a modeling agency represents you and finds you modeling work, the agency will take a commission ranging from 10% to 20%. As with supermodels in the fashion world, there are top-of-the-line parts models who get high fees. An example is Ellen Sureau, one of the highest paid hand and foot models in the U.S. She appeared on a TV show called The Big Idea, hosted by Donny Deutsch. Sureau said the very highest paid hand models can earn as much as $10,000 a day. But feet modeling doesn't pay as much because there aren't as many foot jobs. Top foot models can earn from $500 to $2,000 per hour, she added. It is not enough to have beautiful hands and feet. You have to be able to act with them too, said Sureau. You need those parts to show emotions and feelings to successfully sell a product. To succeed in this area of modeling, you have to keep your hands or feet in exquisite shape. Sureau said she wears shoes one size too big to protect her feet. She said she never wears high heels or pointy shoes, except when she's modeling. Nikki Donahoe, age 37, is a hand, foot, and leg model in Great Britain. She told the Daily Mail that she goes to great lengths to protect them. She wears cotton gloves when she leaves the house, even when she's sunbathing. And she moisturizes her hands and feet up to 10 times a day to keep her fingers and toes in tip-top condition. Donahoe does about 2 body part modeling jobs a week and has appeared on television ads around the world. The former makeup artist told the Daily Mail that being a body parts model is the hardest work of any job I've ever had. I'm Mary Gottschall.
This is What's Trending Today. Last week, British Prime Minister David Cameron announced a plan that would require women immigrants to learn English within 30 months of arriving in Great Britain. The plan targets Muslim women joining their husbands already in Britain. Cameron said his plan would help Muslim women immigrants who spend most of their time at home. He said the plan would help them feel less socially isolated. A government source told the media that David knows that the traditional submissiveness of Muslim women is a sensitive issue. Submissiveness is a willingness to obey or submit to someone else. Some British Muslim women were offended by the comment. They responded on social media with humor and sarcasm. Sarcasm is the use of words that mean the opposite of what you really want to say. Mashable.com reported that British author and activist Shalina John Mohammed created the hashtag traditionally submissive. She tweeted sarcastic responses to Prime Minister Cameron. In one tweet, she wrote, "I bought a sports car and published a book in English and 8 other languages. I must be doing this wrong." Throughout the weekend, more than 30,000 tweets with the hashtag were sent to David Cameron's Twitter account. Women tweeted hashtag traditionally submissive along with a photo of them holding a sign that listed their accomplishments and life experiences. Many of the women listed their university degrees, professional goals, athletic interests, and a long list of languages they speak fluently, including English. And that's What's Trending Today.
We leave you with this week's education report. You might think that the cost of college in the United States depends on which university you attend. But even students who attend the same university pay very different amounts of money. John Russell explains.
Congressional Research Services reports that over the past 25 years, college fees rose almost 2% faster than inflation every year. This suggests that college has become expensive relative to the cost of living. At the same time, a college education is increasingly valuable. College graduates earn more money and have better career prospects than those who only have a high school degree. In the U.S., 3 main sources of money give revenue to colleges. They are government appropriations, gift and endowment revenue, and payments for tuitions and fees. If one source of revenue decreases, colleges often look to raise revenue in another place. When students talk about the price of college, they are usually referring to payments for tuition and fees. Both public and private schools engage in price discrimination, which means charging different prices to different students. Adam Davidson, writing in the New York Times, says that the rise of college prices is a sign of market competition in elite colleges. If colleges publish a high price, they can attract top students with financial aid. The greater the reduction in the tuition, the more likely schools may be in attracting successful students to build the school's reputation. Davidson reports that colleges often use computer programs to give a price. The price reflects a student's willingness to pay, academic record, ethnicity, and the major that they are likely to choose. While colleges publish one price, the sticker price, They really have many price points. Davidson says the price offered to students is based on how attractive the student is to the school. One problem with this, says Congressional Research Services, is that it means that college costs are not transparent. Students are not able to directly compare the cost of schools. Michael Leachman and Michael Mitchell are researchers at the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities. They write that the high sticker price of education may discourage poor students from applying to college. Leachman and Mitchell write that poor students, and particularly poor minority students, benefit from enrolling in selective, expensive schools. But many poor students may be unaware of the available financial aid. They are only aware of the sticker price. Many do not apply to colleges whose sticker price seems too high. In general, states cut funding to higher education during economic recessions. The recession of 2007 through 2009 was no different. States collected less tax money and appropriated less money for higher education. In the U.S., states provide around 53% of the revenue used to support state schools. When states appropriate less per student, schools raise fees to pay expenses. Schools also cut other costs, such as the amount of financial aid given to students. Michael Mitchell, an expert at the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, says,
"One way that state schools have been looking to try and make up the difference is by actually offering smaller scholarship packages or smaller grant packages to wealthier students, students that can actually pay the rest of that tuition price, and moving away from larger grant packages to low-income students."
Even if a student receives a scholarship or grant, they may still need to borrow money to pay for school. Student debt has become the largest source of household debt in the United States. The Federal Reserve Bank of New York estimates that student loans grew to almost $1.2 trillion in 2014. Many students cannot pay back the money they borrowed. They default on their loans. The U.S. Department of Education says that of the 4.7 million students who started repaying their student loans in 2011, almost 650,000, or 13.7%, defaulted before the end of 2013. Some, such as the candidates for the Harvard Board of Overseers, suggest making endowments pay for college costs. Harvard, for example, has an endowment that is worth around $35.9 billion. The University of Texas system, a public school system, has an endowment worth around $25.4 billion. Endowments are investment funds maintained for the benefit of a college. However, donors may restrict how schools spend their endowment money. Congressional Research Services says that almost 40% of permanent endowment money is donor-restricted. Jeff Neal, a spokesperson for Harvard, said that endowments are not like bank accounts, where money is easily deposited or withdrawn. Mitchell, at the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, says that many schools have small endowments or have no endowments at all. Those schools cannot use their endowment to pay expenses in an emergency.
It's only a very small segment that can really look at endowment as a viable kind of safety net in that regard.
From VOA Learning English, I'm John Russell.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.